Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM radio. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound. It can also be heard streaming live worldwide on WVOX.com. One can also call directly to the station at 914-636-0110, but please stay germane to our topic. My guest today is Professor Donald Goldstein, author, historian, and renowned expert on World War II. Our subject today is the atomic bombing of Japan 67 years ago this week, right or wrong. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. To that end, many of my shows are devoted to that purpose. Welcome, Professor Goldstein, back to the Advocates, and thank you for joining me today at WVOX.
Glad to be here.
Great. Dr. Donald Goldstein is a retired Air Force officer who served for 22 years. He is currently a professor emeritus of public and international affairs, the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Pittsburgh. He's taught at the Air Force Academy, Air War College, many other places. He's a former associate dean at University of Pittsburgh. He's currently on the faculties, the Asian Studies, Eastern European, Western European, and Honors Program at the University of Pittsburgh. He's been the author of numerous books. I have one of them in front of me. He's that includes 27 books, 70 articles. His most famous as a co-author is With At Dawn We Slept, The Untold Story of Pearl Harbor. He was on last December 7th talking about the myths of Pearl Harbor. It's in its 20th printing. The book was runner-up for the Pulitzer Prize in 1982 and was on the bestseller list for 47 weeks. I'm handling and I'm just opening his book, Miracle at Midway, which was a bestseller for 9 weeks. There are a number of other books I could spend time mentioning. He averages over 200 talks a year to radio, TV, civic organizations, been awarded 2 Peabody Awards for his work on Pearl Harbor, 2 Hours That Changed the World with David Brinkley. In addition to his PhD from the University of Denver, Dr. Goldstein holds a Bachelor of Arts, 3 master's degrees, and is a graduate of the Air Command and Staff College and the Air War College. He's married with 4 children, his wife, Marianne. They live in Florida. And this is a great pleasure, again, to have Dr. Goldstein with us today. You know, this week, on August 6, 1945, the United States Army Air Force's 509th Composite Bombing Group, under the command of Colonel Paul W. Tibbets, Jr., and his crew of the B-29, and Enola Gay, dropped the first atomic bomb in Hiroshima. 3 days later, on August 9th, under the command of Major Charles Sweeney and his crew of the B-29 boxcar, the second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. The development of this weapon was culminated at Alamogordo, New Mexico, under the guidance of Professor Robert Oppenheimer and General Leslie Groves. Professor Goldstein, could you describe Japan's attitude, its military economic position regarding the Pacific War in the wake of the successful and costly, for all sides that is, invasions of Okinawa, Iwo Jima, and the Philippines? What was their position at this time in August of 1945?
Well, real short, the Japanese were defeated. They were finished. But their samurai code, the Bushido code, their samurai, much like the Al-Qaeda, they would have fought to the end. They believed that the emperor was supreme, that the emperor was a descendant of God, the sun goddess, back in 400 when the Japanese islands were created. And when the Allies came out with the unconditional surrender, which meant that the emperor might have to go, they were willing to fight. They had, at that time, over 10,000 kamikaze people ready to get into airplanes, human bombs, and fight on. They had fought like heck at Iwo Jima. They had fought in Okinawa. And so the idea was, if the Americans are going to get us, they're going to pay, or the Allies, they're going to pay big, big Our estimate was, and I think it's wrong, that it would take about 500,000 to a million American lives to capture the Japanese islands. Because if they fought so hard in the Japanese mainland, if they fought so hard in these islands, they would fight harder. Mm. So their mentality was, while many of the people knew they were defeated, they were not going to give up, particularly unconditionally.
No question. You know, though almost forgotten today, the American losses vis-a-vis the U.S. Marines and Army, along with our naval forces, were horrendous. Aside from the Philippine campaign, in the two major battles fought from February to June, the United States, which is, of course, Iwo Jima and Okinawa, the United States has sustained almost 20,000 killed and close to 100,000 wounded. Along with those horrible losses, hundreds of ships were damaged by kamikaze attacks. Professor, with all this in mind and the American doctrine of unconditional surrender, what would America have faced with regards to a full frontal invasion and assault on Japan?
We were going to win. There's no doubt about it. The question would be, what would be the cost? And many will say, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves too much, that we didn't have to drop the bomb because we would have won. And that is the truth. We didn't. But by dropping the bomb, we ended the war much faster. And so we saved lives. But for someone who lives today, I don't want to be a sound like a killer or something. They can't understand that because they weren't there. But if you were on the beaches of Okinawa waiting to go, or you were your family was there, you wanted that war to end, and that bomb did end the war, even though you could say by today's standards it's unacceptable.
Now, planners, there were many planners in the Pentagon regarding this. What were their estimates correct of millions of men under arms, and as you mentioned, 10,000 volunteers for kamikaze planes and 5,000 planes available. Was this correct, or was there overestimates, or was their information flawed?
It probably was overestimates because we were bombing these guys at will. We had killed 100,000 people in one air raid in April over Tokyo, 100,000, which is more than we're going to get into when we drop the bomb. We were bombing them at will. They were defenseless. This is not the Japan of today. Their houses were made of flimsy wood or straw, whatever you have it. And it would have been devastating for them, but they would have fought on. And it would have taken two or three more months to defeat them, which means that more of them would have died, definitely more of them, and it cost many of ours. How many? You know, military, in which I was one for 22 years, in intelligence, we tend to exaggerate. No doubt, though, they would have been many, many casualties. Mm.
And they certainly printed up a heck of a lot of Purple Hearts and a tremendous amount of body bags. They had a sense that losses would be horrendous. What of all the logistics and the power of Japan that still had, what scared our military planners most? Would it have been the percentage of hits on our fleet, especially the troop carriers, through these kamikaze planes?
Yes, but in the final, we kept the secret. For many years, we said they weren't very successful at Okinawa and those places. Sun Tzu, the great military thinker, once said, find something that the enemy cherishes the most, and you can defeat them. What Americans cherish the most, and rightly so, are lives. Mm. But life to us meant everything. A life to them, believe it or not, didn't, because the country and God came first, and God was Hirohito. So Lord knows what it would have done. You know, and I say this because I got to be honest, the people that think we should have dropped the bomb would say, well, we would have won anyway, and that's true. The question is how many would have been lost, and they would have been thousands. We really don't know. Rather than say a half a billion or a million, I'm just going to say a lot of people.
Now, obviously, one of the essences of the Pacific War was our ability to invade islands, and we did it very, very successfully. But what we learned, starting earlier than Iwo Jima and Okinawa, was that the kamikaze, the human bomb, they also used Baker bombs, they used a lot of other things. You know, the statistics on ships being hit versus planes being knocked down were still horrendous. In other words, if you knock down 95% of all the attacking planes, and there were 5,000 planes, 250 of these planes would have gotten through. If these planes would have aimed at the troop carriers, the ships loaded with men, what would have been the consequences? Could we have sustained that type of defensive tactics. What's your evaluation of that?
Looking at this thing with hindsight, yes, we'd have to have the will. In the final analysis, they had the Lord is on the side of those with most battalions in many aspects. We had the manpower. We had the people to do this. The question is, would we want to do this? And I guess the answer is, in those days, nobody could tell you not to do it. I mean, it's a lot different. You don't have Fox News and CNN and all of them telling you what's happening, and no one is there, and the reporters are going to be pro-military. So, yes, we would have sustained it. Yes, we were committed at this time. We were.
Hello? Okay. I think we lost.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay, good. It's very interesting about that, because I think the mindset of the people of today in the 21st century is a lot different. But it's interesting how the suicide bomber, which was the kamikaze or the bonsai charge, actually wound up having its heirs in Al-Qaeda. And that we have learned that state-sponsored suicide is a very, very difficult tactic to eliminate completely. In other words, war has changed. When a person is willing to give their life in terms of action, and of course, you had 80 million Japanese in those days, and many of them were willing, as you articulated, to give their lives.
It's their religion. That's the thing that we didn't understand. Their religion said that the emperor, the sun god, had created the islands, and the emperor, and even today, allegedly, the emperor today is a descendant. It's the largest, it's the longest living dynasty in the history of the world, 1600 or 1700 years. This guy is a descendant of the first emperor. And they've kept that going. So, yes, it's hard for us to understand that, because we think of Japan today as this modern country, and it is, but then it wasn't.
I have to go to a break. My guest is writer and professor Donald Goldstein, co-author of the world-renowned and highly respected History of Pearl Harbor Attack, At Dawn We Slept, 20 other histories that range from the Battle of Midway to Normandy landings and the life of Amelia Earhart. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM. Live streaming at WVOX, we're going to go to a short financial news update.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour, here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, productivity rose 1.6% in the second quarter, topping economists' expectations. That's also above the 0.5% drop we saw in the first quarter, which was a smaller decline than first estimated. Meanwhile, labor costs rose 1.7%, and that was well above the forecast. Hewlett-Packard shares are getting a boost after it raised its earnings outlook for the third quarter. The company says it now expects to report a profit of $1 per share versus the earlier estimate of 97 cents. HP says the better outlook is largely due to a higher than anticipated acceptance rate under its early retirement program. And shares of McDonald's are down after the company reported that global same-store sales in July were flat compared to a year ago. The fast food giant blames austerity measures in Europe and economic volatility around the world for the results. In the U.S., sales were down slightly last month, and they were worse in Europe. With Fox Business Report, I'm Lauren Simonetti.
Jay with SafeLight Auto Glass.
We know you depend on your vehicle, so when you have auto glass damage, you need it fixed fast. SafeLight has more glass in stock than anyone, so when you schedule a replacement with SafeLight, we'll get you back on your way faster. Plus, our work is backed by the only national lifetime guarantee, keeping you covered anywhere.
Just tell your insurance company you want SafeLight, or call 1-800-800-2727, or go to SafeLight.com.
SafeLight Repair, SafeLight Replace.
1460 WVOX.
There's always something happening with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com.
According to, welcome back to The Advocates. Of course, you're listening to WVOX 1460 radio, live streaming at WVOX.com. My guest, Professor Donald Goldstein. We've been talking about the atomic bombings of Japan, which happened 67 years ago this week, and whether that action was right or wrong. Professor Goldstein, according to the agreement at the Potsdam Conference, which was held in Potsdam, Germany from July 17 to August 2, 1945, a declaration and warning was given to Japan the remaining combatant from the former Axis alliance. Could you tell us what that warning contained, and when did Truman learn about the success of the first test of the atomic bomb?
Well, Truman knew about this, the success of this bomb in July. While he was there, he knew that the Armagata thing had succeeded. But too, Truman was a little leery, and let me just digress a little bit, a little leery of Stalin. You see, the Japanese were negotiating with the Russians for a peace treaty. And this peace treaty was going to be not what Potsdam, but they wanted certain conditions to keep their emperor, to keep their islands, to keep their form of government, and to try their own people. And, of course, this was unacceptable. Mm-hmm. It was unacceptable because way back, if people forget this, 20 years before, well, actually 20-some by that time, World War One had been fought, and there the Germans, Hitler, and another story, had said they were never defeated, that no Allied soldiers on their soil. So we, the U.S. people, wanted to make sure, and the Allies said, by God, this time they know they were beaten. The same guys that were at Versailles, guys like John Foster Dulles, people that fought in World War One, like Ike and like MacArthur and like Patton, all that, had all seen this happen, and therefore they wanted to make sure that this wouldn't happen again. The Japanese were negotiating with the Russians. The Russians, believe it or not, had made a deal that they would be unconditional. The thing that Truman was worried about was, in the early days, which you so eloquently brought out earlier, we were worried about the losses. Well, by July, August, we realized that we didn't need the Russians to go in there. We weren't going to use our troops. We had this bomb that nobody knew what it would do, but that would be devastating, and that we would warn these guys. If we didn't, we'd drop them, and this war might end. And so we changed our tune. Now, we changed our tune real fast, and this is important, because in Europe, the Russians were behaving very badly. The Russians, we had made deals with them that the government in Czechoslovakia and Austria and Romania and Bulgaria would all be democratic when the Russians occupied those places. And of course, they did that because they were afraid of another Hitler and Napoleon. They wanted to have this living space. When they occupied this land, they kept their guys in there. We were worried that, at least the Allies, that if the Russians came in too early, and they made a commitment that at the end of the war, there'd be another agreement which, like Potsdam, instead of dividing Germany, would divide Japan into North Japan and South Japan. Hmm. Now, there's every reason real fast to believe this. I'm trying to go fast here. Would believe this because the war, we dropped the bomb on the 6th. The Russians came on the 7th of August, dropped the second one on the 9th, and the war was over on the 10th. And for those 4 days, the Russians occupied Manchuria, gave arms to Mao rather than Chiang, our guy, gave arms to Ho Chi Minh rather than our guy, Bao Dai in Vietnam. They gave Kim Il-sung the North Korea, and so they were already in that area. And by God, if the war lasts 2 or 3 months at the peace treaty, they're going to be there. And people don't realize this. They would have had a big say. As it was, they had very little say about the end of the war there.
Mm. Now, history has recorded that at Potsdam, when Truman hinted at the existence of a powerful weapon that could end the war, Marshal Stalin did not seem surprised. With that in mind, and with the drawing up of the Potsdam Declaration, along with the delineation of the role that all the Allies would play with regards to the final defeat of Japan, what was the military and political and social reality? In other words, you bring up about the Russian negotiation, but what was the condition? Were they really capable of fighting, you think?
Well, you know, you get Russia, and let's give them great credit. They were the great victors in the Atlantic because we helped them, and the guys that died at the Bulge and D-Day, and then we give them credit. The Russians really were the main participants in the war in Europe. Well, the war in the Pacific was a really American war. The Brits had been finished. We had some Australians, et cetera, British Empire people, but it was an American war fought by American troops, et cetera. Well, now the Russians are all getting involved, and the Russians had a big army, a big military thing. There's no doubt that the Russians attacked the Japanese, who they hated, incidentally, because they had been beaten in 1905, this war would have ended in 2 or 3 months anyway with some Russian casualties and a big say.
Quick question for you on this. When Marshal Stalin sort of sloughs off the news of the atomic bomb, is that because he was already informed by Russian spies out of project in New Mexico?
Oh, no doubt. Oppenheimer, in fact, Oppenheimer is buried in Monroe. I mean, he's given a burial by those people. Oppenheimer and Kuntz and those guys, this is bad because the right wing would say this, the academics, they were basically left of center, and once the bomb was developed, Oppenheimer himself, they tried to stop even using it. The Russians had spies within the whole operation and knew what was going on.
Right. In other words, the Manhattan Project had been compromised, not by Oppenheimer, but others, Fuchs and other spies. And yes, it seems that Oppenheimer and many liberals were afraid of the consequence of using the bomb, the consequence of it. You know, at that time, there seemed to be few different alternatives to dealing with Japan. One could have been waiting to allow them to starve. The second was a demonstration bombing, not on civilians. Third was dropping a bomb on targets. Could you explain how the planners addressed these alternatives? We only have a minute or so left. And was there any thought to invading and not using the bomb?
Yes, very much so, because even Ike and those guys said this bomb was up, but nobody really knew what the bomb would do. Can you imagine me telling you, here's a bomb, come on out here and watch me, and the bomb goes, whoop, doesn't go off like a Roman candle. They never knew what it was going to happen, you know. And so that was out, because you couldn't demonstrate something that you weren't sure what it would do, and it may even kill people watching it. The second point was, you probably could have starved them, but this would have actually, we thought about that. We were bombing, again, this is important, we were bombing them at will. We had only saved these five cities, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Kyoto, two others. We had Kokura. We had saved them for the use of the bomb. Every other city was devastated. I mean, we had destroyed this country completely with our firebomb raids. If you want to hang somebody for being inhuman, it would be Curtis LeMay and,
right,
and the incendiary bombs, which were really inhuman in terms of killing people.
They bombed and burned out about 60 cities in Japan. They had actually run out of targets, and they had literally burned down half of Tokyo. And it's very interesting whether this would have been, and of course, history loves to second guess what happens. But it's very interesting, even the debate in those days. My guest, we're going to commercial break. My guest is writer, professor Donald Goldstein, co-author of the world-renowned, highly respected history of Pearl Harbor, At Dawn We Slept, 20 other histories. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM radio, live streaming at WVOX. We're going to go to a short commercial break, and we'll be back in a moment.
With world and national news three times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Ron Flatter. The FBI says Wade Page acted alone Sunday when he attacked a Sikh temple near Milwaukee, killing six people and then himself.
The first arriving officer on scene was shot by Wade Michael Page in the parking lot. And then the next arriving officer, we were told, shot Page and brought him down. Well, today the FBI confirmed that officer shot Page in the stomach. And then Page, after he was knocked down, took his own weapon and put a bullet in his own head.
Fox's Rick Leventhal in Wisconsin. A bomb threat was phoned in to one building at the Walter Reed Military Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland.
They evacuated it, going through it, trying to follow up on a call with a threat that was pretty specific, saying that a device would explode in Building 19 at a certain time. That time has passed, but they are still sweeping that building.
Fox's Harris Faulkner. Fox News. We report, you decide.
There are quite a number of neighborhood flower shops around Westchester County these days. As in all things, some are better than others. And in the Colonial Village Shopping Center on Weaver Street in Scarsdale, just to the north of New Rochelle, there exists a florist of very great style and renown. Colonial Village Flowers specializes in beautiful seasonal flowers arranged in good taste, with the lovely low-key result that all Colonial Village presentations, bouquets, and arrangements look like they were actually grown, collected, and gathered in the natural setting of your own garden. Good taste in flowers has for years been a special trademark of Joe Ward and his talented floral arrangers at Colonial Village. featuring the natural look, without pomp or ceremony. So please, know that there is at least one flower shop on your classy wavelength. Joe Ward's Colonial Village Flowers at 1515 Weaver Street in Scarsdale. Call 723-2888. That's 723-2-3-8.
Ladies and gentlemen, be ready. For the first time in New York, this new show, The Seer, with Prophet Zogo. Every Tuesday at 5:30 p.m., Wednesday 5:30 p.m., and Saturday 6:30 p.m. Your life will never ever be the same. So listen to The Scene every Tuesday at 5:30 p.m., Wednesday 5:30 p.m., and Saturday 6:30 p.m. here on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Your life will never ever be the same.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
The forecast, Westchester County and the vicinity for this Wednesday afternoon. Skies remain mostly sunny, highs will climb into the upper 80s. Increasing clouds this evening, continued muggy overnight lows falling back into the lower 70s. Partly sunny, shower thunderstorm possible Thursday afternoon. Highs will range into the upper 80s. Our outlook for your Friday, showers, thunderstorms, likely highs into the lower 70s. More the same weather Saturday with some showers and thunderstorms. Temperatures will climb middle 80s. Steve Pelletieri, Jr. reporting for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
Whether you're working,
I like to listen to music when I work,
or working out,
when I'm in the gym,
we're working for you. VOX.
WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates. You're listening to WVOX Radio, 1460 AM. Of course, live streaming at WVOX.com. My guest today is Professor Donald Goldstein. We've been talking about the atomic bombings of Japan, which happened 67 years ago this week, and whether that action was right or wrong. You know, Professor Goldstein, in the decades following the defeat and unconditional surrender of Japan, various historians have written about Japan's diplomatic efforts with the Soviet Union to seek a negotiated peace. And, of course, you mentioned that earlier. Did the United States know of this effort? And with this in mind, did they fear a brokered peace through the Soviets?
Yes, they did. They knew about it. We were very good at reading the Japanese codes by then, tremendously. In fact, we knew everything they were doing. Yes, we knew they were doing. Yes, we were worried about the Soviet Union. Again, because they were our ally, but they weren't behaving. We had people back in Pittsburgh, where I was for many years, and New York, waiting to go to govern Poland, to govern. And when they went back, they were killed. They were persecuted by Stalin. So, yes, we were very much worried.
Yeah. You know, as a follow-up to the Yalta Conference and in the wake of FDR's death in April 1945, concern, as you mentioned, started to appear amongst the Western allies with regards to Stalin's designs on both Poland and Eastern Europe. Even though the Soviets had honored every agreement, both Churchill and FDR's successor, Harry S. Truman, started to worry about the future peace. Even Roosevelt understood, you know, he had a different view of this. It's an excellent book about Roosevelt's lost alliances and his feeling that the Polish electorate here had nothing to do with the problem of, and he had even thought that the Poles were just as guilty as the Russians in terms of hundreds of years of animosity. Could you give us an insight into the fears of the Western allies, and did they also fear the effect of atomic bombing on politics? In other words, the essence of using this kind of weapon and what the reverberations would be.
Well, that's a tough one. Real fast, as we know, we don't know, the Cold War didn't start after 45. It started back in 1918. When Stalin comes to power and the World War I is over, the great powers, including the United States, invaded Russia. It was a four-year war. We know that Lenin won and that his colleagues were Stalin and Trotsky, that he appointed Stalin, and that Stalin begins to see that the real enemy is the West. and that they had Russia had been invaded by the Germans. They had been invaded by the Genghis Khan's group. They had been invaded by Napoleon, and so he was looking for what we call Ravensturm. And so Russian foreign policy from the 1920s on was to defend, to have Eastern Europe as buffer zones, Poland, et cetera, so that Czechoslovakia, so that when the West ever invaded again, they would be ready. So they saw the world entirely different. We saw the world as bad. Communism as bad. We had not McCarthy, but we had J. Mitchell Palmer. We had Sacco Vanzetti. We had a lot of anti-communism going on in the world. We know that Hitler comes to power, that Hitler's major enemy besides the poor Jews was the Bolsheviks. I mean, he was very, very anti-communism. Stalin saw this, but he makes a deal with Hitler because Hitler didn't want to fight a two-front war real fast. We know what the deal was. They divvied up Poland, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, and Russia expanded a little bit more. So, yes, we were really worried about this. We were worried that the Russians would be the one. Churchill. Patton, some of the right-wing guys really wanted to keep going. Roosevelt was more of a guy who thought he could deal with Uncle Joe, who thought that the world was more like the United Nations, which has been a kind of fail to me, but you could argue that it would be better than the League of Nations. We would join it. We would stop these guys. So, yes, we were worried much about the Russians, particularly in July, particularly after Roosevelt dies, because now the new leader, Truman, who only meets Roosevelt twice while he's in office, doesn't really know what's going on, has to make some great decisions about the emperor, about Japan. Real fast, people have asked me, why didn't we treat Iraq like Japan? And the answer was that MacArthur, bad as he may have been as a general, we could argue this one, understood the Japanese mentality. We kept the emperor. We kept the infrastructure. We did have trials in Tokyo war crime, but we kept them. In Iraq, we killed everybody. We didn't kill everybody. We tried everybody, so they had no infrastructure. Plus, they had three different countries. So, in a way, yes, without rambling too much here, we were really worried about the Russians and what they were going to do. But we understood Japan better than most people thought.
You know, it's interesting as you bring that up, and of course the differences of opinion, you know, on the anniversary of Roosevelt's death on April 11th, one day before it, 67 years ago. I did a program with Frank Castiglioli of University of Connecticut, a wonderful program on his book, The Lost Alliances, FDR's Lost Alliances. And of course his postulation is that if FDR had lived, he may have been able to go to Stalin, speak to him, go above his head to the Russian people, and deal with a division of the world between the U.S., Russia, Great Britain, and China, and end these, you know, local regional wars that went on incessantly before the big wars and after the big wars. But getting, and of course, this is a debatable subject, Averill Harriman said at the end, and he was one of the Roosevelt people who opposed, after Roosevelt's death, really dealing with the Soviets because he felt no one could do it. He said later in retrospect, only Roosevelt could have handled it. But that's hindsight and, you know, things change. You know, getting back to the Potsdam Declaration, the emerging climate with the advisors around Truman, who were against using the bomb on civilian population? And what was the issue regarding the inventory of usable atomic weapons? Was there enough to continue that?
We only had two bombs. We had three bombs, one at Alamogordo, and the two, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We had no other bombs. We did not have any. Number two, one reason they wanted to drop the Nagasaki one, too, was that it was a different bomb. It was a plutonium bomb. It was uranium. So they were different types of bombs. And there was a lot of politics about not dropping it. But then people said, well, God, we spent all this money. What would the American people think if we never used the doggone thing? Secondly, what would it do? No one can imagine, I can't, that you drop a bomb in New York City, and we saw it at the World Trade Center, but it would destroy, it would go all the way to Brooklyn, it would take Richmond and Manhattan and the Queens and the Bronx out with one daggum bomb. Well, we just can't picture that. And so they were really concerned. They didn't know what it would do. They were very much concerned. Our inventory was very low. Many people, many of the generals said, this is a humane thing. We shouldn't be using this kind of bomb. Burns was the Secretary of State. He was definitely for it. Harriman was definitely for it. Truman had to make this decision. And again, hindsight, going the other way with hindsight, the right-wing hindsight would be, My God, suppose my daddy was on the beaches of Okinawa. They were getting ready to go, and they dropped this bomb, and the war is over. 4 days after the first one is dropped, I'm happy. I've talked to thousands, literally thousands of veterans, and I've never seen one, I'm sure they are some, who said we shouldn't have dropped the bomb. They were happy. They were coming home. This war had lasted not 6 months, not a year terms. These guys were over there for the duration 4.5 years, from 1941 all the way through 45, had never come home, hadn't seen their kids, et cetera. So this was it was a lot of politics here, and there were pros and cons, but there were more pros than cons at that time.
Using hindsight,
you could argue, well, let it drag out a little bit. Not because I told you this, the estimate was wrong. Maybe we still would have won the war. We didn't have to drop it. And the answer is yes, but the answer is also, what would the world have been like?
You know, now, Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson, a great patriot, one of our top diplomats and a person who held office with Republicans and Democrats for 40 years up to that time, he objected to the bombing of Kyoto. What was his reasoning about that?
Well, Kyoto was the Vatican, an analogy. That's the holy city. That's where the emperor allegedly began. And so they didn't want to do this to unite the Japanese people against religion. I mean, bombing Hiroshima was one thing, bombing the holy shrines and the Buddhist temples and the Shinto stuff, that would have been very, very bad. So he was against that. Stimson is kind of a funny man. Back in the 20s, when we had broken the Japanese code, and he was the Secretary of State at the time, when he heard about it, he said, "Gentlemen, don't read other people's mail."
That's a famous quote.
About 10 years on intelligence. When he became Secretary of War, he was a little more bellicose.
Right, and a little more realistic. Of course, we still had the black room. We still were working on codes.
There you go.
And we still worked on all the, Japanese naval purple code.
Which, incidentally, not our topic, but may have been the greatest invention of that. May have been the key to the whole war, the breaking of ultra and magic codes.
No question about it. And that's been many books, many things, very interesting treatments on that. It's a fascinating subject. One day I'll talk about the code breakers and their impact. Again, we're going to a commercial break. My guest is writer and professor Donald Goldstein, co-author of the world-renowned, highly respected history of Pearl Harbor attack at dawn we slept, 20 other major histories that range from Midway to Normandy landings. You're listening to The Advocates and WVOX Radio 1460, live streaming at WVOX. We're going to go to a short commercial break, and we'll be back with our guest soon.
World and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Carol McHugh. Sikh temple shooter Wade Michael Page shot himself in the head after being wounded by police following Sunday's massacre in Wisconsin. It appears he was on his own. As for a motive?
We still have identified no one else responsible for the shooting other than him. We also have not clearly defined a motive at this point.
FBI agent Teresa Carlson. The economy and more on the agenda today as President Obama campaigns in Colorado.
In addition to the economy, women's health care is the subject of the president's first stop today in Denver in front of a mostly female audience.
Fox News Radio's Rich Johnson. Mitt Romney's in Iowa. You can be sure the Americans will win this Olympic contest today.
The women's beach volleyball, a cinch win for Team USA. The finals are an all-American affair. Misty May Traynor and Kerry Walsh Jennings going for a third straight gold, having yet to lose in an Olympic setting. They face April Ross and Jennifer Kesey.
Fox's Phil Lytner in London. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Be sure to listen to WVOX Local News early mornings on Good Morning Westchester, brought to you exclusively by Trustco Bank. Need a mortgage? Think Trustco Bank for great savings with no PMI, no tax escrow, and no broker's fees. For more details, go to TrustcoBank.com. Trustco Bank, your hometown bank. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Wherever you listen.
In the shower.
I listen to it all the time. I listen at work, in my car, when I get up.
Thanks for keeping it here. WVOX Worldwide.
The voice of Westchester. WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates. You're listening to WVOX 1460 AM radio, live streaming at WVOX.com. My guest is Professor Donald Goldstein. We've been talking about the atomic bombings of Japan, which happened 67 years ago this week, and whether that action was right or wrong, different perspectives on it, how the war could have ended better, quicker, less casualties on both sides. You know, President Truman has been judged quite well by history. In the wake of the death of FDR, a great burden fell on this man from Missouri, who was considered much less sophisticated, worldly, and knowledgeable than his illustrious predecessor. He emphatically stated that the wives, mothers, and children of hundreds of thousands of Americans lost in a potential invasion of Japan would never forgive him if they knew he had a weapon to end the war immediately. Professor Goldstein, could you tell us some of the range of the estimates and who were these different groups, you know, talking about the potential casualties regarding both the Allies and the Japanese military and civilian population if there was a frontal assault? In other words, this Truman wasn't working in a vacuum. There were a lot of people working on this. Who are some of these people?
Well, of course, and due respect to those out there that don't like the bomb, they were right-wingers. I mean, they were people in the military. They were guys that had seen what had happened at Okinawa. At the Battle of Attu, for example, in Alaska, which nobody ever talks about, the Japanese took 95% casualties. So their casualty rates were tremendous. In fact, about 10 years ago, we still found some people on Guam who hadn't surrendered yet because they thought the war was still going to go on. And in Japan, you don't surrender. We know that something happened in Iraq a few years ago, and these two newsmen were captured, and they went home, and instead of getting a hero's welcome, they were treated very shabbily, because in Japan, you don't surrender. You do not surrender. You do not give up. It is your responsibility. So based upon the philosophy, based upon how they had fought at Okinawa, how they fought at Attu, how they fought at Iwo Jima, and there are tens of movies on this kind of stuff, these guys would have fought. So therefore, it was the estimate. Now, you really can't estimate. You know, we always estimate how many people died in America. And this is important. Again, death is important. The biggest battle in our history took place at a place called Antietam, Charlottesburg. 26,470 people died. That is the largest casualties of any battle in American history. Well, my God, some of these battles in Europe in World War I, 100,000, 200,000, a half a million people died or there were casualties. So we were basing this on a fanatical people who we had fought, and we thought, and so this was the estimate. Now, again, I'm with people on the left on this. I don't think that many would have died, but certainly many would have died, and certainly many more of their people would have died. I can't emphasize that enough, because their cities are all open, and we're just bombing them at will. They've got nothing left to fight us with except kamikazes and hand-to-hand type fighting.
You know, on August 6th, in reflection of 1945, the first bomb leveled the city of Hiroshima, and the amount of casualties have been estimated around 70,000 at the time of the impact, to possibly twice that amount from the results of injuries and sickness. With the evidence of the destructive power of the single bomb, what caused Japan to hesitate and not immediately capitulate?
You've got to remember, this is 1945. You don't have the technology. You've got to get a table. You've got to get all the guys together. You know, the cabinet ministers, what should we do? They're scattered all over the place. They're at war. And so they had no idea. I mean, this bomb, they thought maybe it was a freak thing. It was the second bomb, which many said we shouldn't have dropped, which convinced them. And this is where I do have some experience, having talked to Fuchida, who led the attack on Pearl Harbor, who was the head of the Air Force at the time, at the end of the war, Genda, who planned the attack and who was a senator in Japan for many, many years. They all said that, my God, the second bomb convinced them that they didn't know we didn't have any more. that they better quit before they lose everything. But until then, the first one was just kind of a wake-up. They said it was a freak thing. The second one convinced them to go. I noticed from talking to Watanabe, who was a chief of staff there, Agenda, Fuchida, Chihaya, and others, that's what they thought, the people that were in power.
And, you know, it's very interesting that when the Japanese officials, and of course the Navy people seemed to be more rational than the Army were very fanatical. When they first moved into Hiroshima, they noticed there was no crater. Of course, it was an air-detonated bomb. There was no crater. And they felt that they could go underground. I mean, this was, and I think this reflects on the view of the people who support the dropping of the A-bombs on Japan, that these people were more or less mad that they could look at a city that was almost totally leveled, not find a crater, and go underground. And, of course, on Iwo Jima and Okinawa, they had gone underground. We practically never saw their troops. They were in tunnels. They were in everything else. So getting back to this, after the second bomb dropped and the devastation on Nagasaki, of course, a different type of devastation. Nagasaki was in a valley, and the explosion was deflected a bit. How did they, what was their impact of their thinking then? And what was the emperor's role in regards to this, where as opposed to the first bomb?
Well, there was some hesitation after the first bomb. After the second bomb, there were some radicals. They almost had a revolution led by young Turks who believed that they should fight on to the bitter end. But the old timers, again, the preceding them, society there, and the emperor, whose voice no one had ever heard before, went on the radio and said to the people, "We're finished." The emperor was, you know, he didn't want to see all his people die. So the second bomb was really the killer. But let me say a couple words. I know we're running time here. The Japanese see the war entirely different than we do. If you go to Japan and you look at their history books, there's very little written about World War II. They just don't seem to discuss it. You go to Pearl Harbor, there's a lot of Japanese visitors who are in awe. But at the 70th anniversary, which I was there with a bunch of veterans, no Japanese came to say, you know, we're kind of sorry about the attack. It's true you can't compare the two. I mean, 2,000 or some people died at Pearl Harbor, and Lord knows how many died at Hiroshima, thousands more. But we got Harry Truman's grandson going over to Hiroshima. Japan sees the world entirely different. They saw they never really acknowledged about World War II to a lot of people. This has antagonized the people of Korea today, even with the comfort women, the rape of Nanking, Unit 731, which makes Hitler's Gestapo look good. This is a unit which did experiments on people's bodies and, shooting them with flu and ice and all that kind of stuff, taking the arms off. They have never really admitted this, even to today, whereas the Germans, bad as they may have been, have always said we were sorry, blah, 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 Hitler was bad. The Japanese have never really done this, and they see World War II in different. In fact, they don't even teach it as such. So you go to Hiroshima, it's like it happened, and it was bad, and it was bad. Please, it's important that I got to agree with a lot of people. This was a bad thing, but they see the world different, and they saw the world different when they were fighting. They would have fought to the last man, I think.
And let's remind our audience that at the Rape of Nanjing, which was in the late 1930s, before the Second World War, they entered the Second World War, they literally killed 200,000 people and buried them in a pit in Nanjing. In the search for the Doolittle Raiders, they arrested and killed a couple of 100,000 Chinese. They used germ warfare. They used gas. They used everything possible against the Chinese population. And over 20 million Chinese lost their lives in the Second World War, and from starvation, from brutality. And of course, as you mentioned, Korea was used as almost a brothel by the Japanese. So there is a kind of sense that they don't have the guilt that maybe they should. They don't have the reflective guilt.
Let's add the Bataan Death March. Right. And see, one of the arguments would have been if the war would have lasted longer. I don't know this. They would have killed a lot more American prisoners just because they killed four of the three of the Doolittle Raiders anyway.
Right.
So it's a different type of people at that time anyway.
Yeah. Looking back on not only the incredible recovery of Japan, their longtime economic and social alliance with America, but the saving of hundreds of thousands of Americans and perhaps millions of Japanese. In conclusion, was the decision correct? And what? And you stated this. I want you to repeat this. What was the attitude of the American servicemen and women about the end of the war, ending so quickly?
From my point of view, and people would say I'm biased, and they have a right to, and you'll never change anybody's mind on this. If you didn't live in that period, you would have said this bomb was devastating. We shouldn't have dropped it. You can find reasons why we couldn't have. You can find it. But if one looks at it closely, no doubt that the bomb ended the war. And if you were an American soldier or American mother or father and your son was saved by this bomb, it was worth it.
Mm. And that's what, you know, as two remarks, General Sherman said, war is hell, no question about it. And I believe General Lee said that men, thank God war is so terrible because men would grow to love it.
That's true. Both of them are correct.
And in a sense that the quick ending of the war, the lack of incredible more tragedy for both sides, aside from the guilt clauses that we know that they ducked, thankfully many hundreds of thousands of lives of Americans were saved and Japan was not destroyed as a country. And there are friends and allies, for better or for worse. Eventually, the generation who understood that war will be gone and it'll be a historical moment. You know, we only have a few seconds left, and I want to thank you, Professor Goldstein, for being a guest again on The Advocates and for your wonderfully crafted insights. I hope to have you back again one day, and we can talk about a few other things. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm sure I didn't change anybody's mind, but I want them to at least think about that. That was then. This is now.
Thank you very much. You know, if you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access on my website, advocates-wvx.com, where information on all my guests will be posted. You can read about Professor Goldstein's long curriculum vitae and resume. It's wonderful. I just want to remind you, next week, The Advocates will be discussing with law author Lou Ilyar his views on gambling, charities, and corruption in America. And by the way, on a social note, I don't usually say this, my daughter Dana will be married this Sunday in Cortland Manor, New York. And we're both, my wife and I, are looking forward to it. The whole family is. My son John and the rest of the family looking forward to this. And I hope to have a great weekend and speak to you next week about gambling, charities, and corruption in America. Thank you again, Professor Goldstein, for coming on and being such a great guest. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Advocates on 1460.